There was one performance this year that stunned me. It sank its hooks in my heart. Not because it was good. There was nothing good about it. But it was effective and it did its job. It made its intended audience laugh and show their teeth. It was that moment when the person asking to sit in the most respected seat in our country imitated a disabled reporter, someone he outranked in privilege, power, and the capacity to fight back.
Meryl Streep at last night's Golden Globe Awards. Today, President-elect Donald Trump took to Twitter to call Streep an overrated Hillary flunky and deny that he mocked a disabled reporter. That's just one piece of Golden Globe's fallout that raises the question, are the awards an opportunity to share serious political and social commentary with millions of people, or are they just a big, silly Hollywood party?
One of our next presenters is Golden Globe winner Jessica Chastain. The other is Golden Globe winner and star of Fantastic Beasts, Eddie Redmayne. That's right, Chastain and the Redmayne.
Chastain and Redmayne!
Chastain and the Redmayne.
Last night's Golden Globe seemed to want it both ways, and here to talk about whether it worked and whether it matters, I'm joined by Kevin Fallon, senior entertainment reporter for The Daily Beast. Welcome.
Hi.
And Eric Deggans, TV critic for NPR. Welcome back, Eric.
Sure.
Kevin, let's begin with you. You wrote today that this mix of silly and serious didn't work last night. Why?
Well, we're used to these shows sort of having a uniform tone and sort of spirit by everyone who's involved, from the host to the people attending and the people winning the awards. And typically it's everyone cheerleading for their shared politics and, you know, their love of themselves. But this time there was a more somber mood, almost an aggravated need to fight back, which certainly was a tone of Meryl Streep's speech. And the frivolity that typically accompanies the awards, that more chipper tone in previous years sort of allows for, seemed really off in contrast to those more somber moments.
And Eric, what do you think? Do you think that the times have called for a more sober Globes?
Well, I mean, you asked at the top of this, you know, whether it was serious or silly. And the weird thing about show business is that it's both. And it often tries to be both in the same moment. And the Globes have always been this party that's supposed to be the sillier, freer, more fun version of the award ceremony that the Oscars wasn't. The Oscars is the serious, somber, you know, everybody pays attention to it, and it's the arbiter of Hollywood kind of thing. And the Golden Globes is supposed to be the young upstart, you know, the irritant that kind of is silly in the face of seriousness. I think that one of the biggest problems here was Jimmy Fallon, the host. You know, we count on TV personalities to be able to navigate that kind of balance. You know, when the election returns come in and it goes the way people don't expect, you expect a Stephen Colbert, a Jimmy Fallon, a Samantha Bee, a Trevor Noah to be able to, on their feet, change direction and reflect the mood of the audience and the tenor of the times. And Fallon just wasn't up to it. He's a silly guy. He's someone who's kind of obsequious in what he does.
He's the guy who ruffled Donald Trump's hair when he came
in. He's been criticized for playing too nice with Trump to begin with. And then he's presented with this show where half the performers want to make very serious cutting remarks about Trump. And his opening monologue, he took a lot of shots at Trump, but they were all kind of silly. They were all kind of, the jokes didn't really land. They sounded like the kind of things that he would have done on The Tonight Show. And he was barely in the show. You know, people often remarked, you know, where's Jimmy? You know, we only saw him in brief moments after he did his opening monologue. So I would put a lot of this, frankly, on the host and his inability to sort of ride that tone in the way that the show needed.
So it appears that Meryl Streep really stole the show last night, or at least that's why we're talking about the show today. And Kevin, do you think that this is signaling a new direction for Hollywood this season? Are we going to see more of this, let's say, at the Oscars and on down the line?
I think you can for sure expect a lot more expression of a need for compassion and a need for empathy and an urging to fight for your beliefs and to fight for opportunity. But I also don't think that's something that's that new. I think that people who are expressing any sort of backlash from Meryl Streep's speech are, you know, frustrated over the fact that Hollywood celebrities are talking about politics at an award show. But that's something that has been going on for 40-some-odd years, stretching back to Marlon Brando bringing on Sachin Littlefeather and, you know, Jane mm-hmm. Fonda and Sally Field and Michael Moore and Al Gore and, you know, everything in between. So I think we can expect a lot more of it, but I don't think it's setting a new direction.
Let me just play another clip of Meryl Streep from last night.
Hollywood is crawling with outsiders and foreigners. And if we kick them all out, you'll have nothing to watch but football and mixed martial arts, which are not the arts.
So is that a bit of a misstep, Eric? You know, MMA and football fans were angered by that. Does that indicate to you that this is a missed opportunity to connect with people who like football, for example?
Right, right. I mean, I do think that one of the weaknesses that we saw with the Democratic establishment was this willingness to sort of write off people that maybe they should have been reaching out to. And I could see why some people would view Meryl Streep's line that way. And I think celebrities always, particularly celebrities who've been famous for a long time and been wealthy and powerful for a long time, they run this risk of looking like elitists when they say things like that. Because there are people who love MMA and people who love you know, sports and NASCAR and all that stuff, who also are horrified by Donald Trump in the same way that they are and would be their allies if they didn't insult the things that they love.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, people say that stuff about celebrities when celebrities are expressing views they don't agree with. When the celebrities are talking about stuff that they agree with, they love it. So I don't think that you can expect artists to be constantly creating things that are about something and then say to them, okay, when the press comes to you and asks you your opinion, you don't get to talk about it. You know, you can talk about it in your art, but we don't want you to talk about it as a person. I think that's unrealistic. So there are going to be times when celebrities, because they're human, will, you know, they'll reveal that they don't know as much about a subject as you would hope, or they might make a misstep and insult people that they shouldn't. But they're saying significant things in their work, so we're all interested in, you know, the personal values and the ideas that fueled that work. We want to hear them talk about it.
Yeah, but I guess you could argue that it's the rare Hollywood production that actually does take on issues of social import.
I would roundly disagree with that. You could. I listed 12 of the best TV shows of 2016. Every single one of them talks about this kind of stuff. And in fact, in television, we've seen this drive to create shows that are about quality. So shows, even shows that are regular situation comedies, you know, I'm here in Pasadena at the TV Critics Press Tour, and CBS is presenting a press conference on a show called Superior Donuts. Now, it's a sitcom, but it's also set in Chicago, and it features a white guy who owns a donut store who partners with a young black guy, and they talk about race, they talk about class, they talk about crime in the context of a sitcom.
Right. TV has been ahead of movies lately, and I guess that's what I was referring to, is more film. When you're thinking of comic book hero action movies and things like that dominating Hollywood. And Kevin, I'm wondering what your take is on this. Do you think that not only are we seeing more, or we're seeing a pointed political statement at these awards shows, but what about in the culture in general in Hollywood?
Yeah, I think that's why I sort of am allergic to the idea that award shows don't matter and that these things are just silly distractions, because it actually does matter who wins. You want someone with a message that Viola Davis has about opportunity and representation and telling stories that deserve to be heard, or someone like Tracee Ellis Ross winning for Black-ish and giving that speech last night.
And I just want to play that Tracee Ellis Ross cut.
This is for all of the women, women of color, and colorful people whose stories, ideas, thoughts are not always considered worthy and valid and important. But I want you to know that I see you, we see you.
So, Eric, you're mentioning that TV is really taking on these issues and is a lot more diverse. Is it the same story again? Oscars so white, but TV is ahead?
Well, you know, what has surprised me is that, you know, we had this whole Oscar so white controversy, and in the very next Oscar season, we have several movies. We have Fences, we have Moonlight. People are pushing for Hidden Figures to get more attention. We have several movies starring people of color where people are pressing for them to be Oscar contenders, and they're considered Oscar contenders. So I think it was a Hollywood problem, and the pressure has forced Hollywood to react, and it has reacted rather quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily think that this complexity and diversity needs to be solely the province of television. And what we're seeing in television is a result of a decade of pressure that started back in 1999 when the NAACP threatened to sue the four big TV networks because of their lack of diversity. And so now the film industry is feeling that same pressure, and it is responding in the way that it has to. And what's interesting to me is people may feel like this is an old conversation, that they're tired of this kind of talk, but then you look at the figures and you see that Tracee Ellis Ross is the first black woman to win best actress in comedy or musical Golden Globe since the 80s.
Hmm.
I mean, it's hard to believe in 2017 that we still have these kind of firsts and these kind of seconds being lodged by people of color, but that just tells you you know, how little diversity there has been, even in television. And it's time to really press to this issue and realize that it's always going to be something that's with us. We're going to have a hard time getting past it.
Eric Deggans, TV critic for NPR, Kevin Fallon, senior entertainment reporter for The Daily Beast. Thank you both.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you. Did you see last night's Golden Globes? What did you think of the show, the speeches, Meryl Streep in particular? Let us know with a voicemail at 844-PRESS-PLAY or on Facebook at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up with legalized marijuana, the hemp industry could be huge in California. So why aren't more entrepreneurs cashing in? That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Donald Trump promised to make America great again by bringing back manufacturing jobs. Today, he met with Jack Ma, the head of the Chinese company Alibaba, about a plan to create 1 million new jobs in the United States. Here's what Jack Ma told reporters at Trump Tower today.
Yes, very productive meeting. We discussed about the helping the American small business selling things through Alibaba platform to China and to Asia.
Today, Trump also tweeted a thanks to Fiat Chrysler for promising to open 2 new manufacturing plants in Ohio and Michigan. So is Donald Trump already living up to his promise? Joining me now to talk about that is Alex Wayne, White House editor for Bloomberg News. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, Fiat's CEO said the company's decision really had nothing to do with Donald Trump, that this plan was in the works for a while now. But Trump seems to be taking credit for it on Twitter. What is the real story there with Fiat?
Well, this is a pattern. Trump comes out on Twitter and claims credit for jobs being created in America by companies that later say they were already planning to do this. America is pretty much the best place to invest in the world right now, so it's not surprising that companies want to open new production.
Okay, so let's talk about that Jack Ma promise. 1 million jobs, mainly in the Midwest. What does that mean?
Again, this is something that Alibaba may have been intending even before the era of Trump. I'll give them a little credit that CEOs are telling us, even as they cower in fear of a Trump tweet directed at their company, that they do expect a better business climate under Trump. They expect less regulation, for example, which should mean higher profit margins.
Right, but that doesn't necessarily translate into bringing back manufacturing to the United States, correct?
No, and even if these plants are built, they're not going to be the kind of manufacturing plants that Donald Trump might be envisioning with thousands of workers. They're going to be largely automated. Jobs across the United States and in every sector are going toward automation. This is a trend that Donald Trump can't stop.
Right, and the United States, I believe, has lost 5 million manufacturing jobs since the year 2000, so it'll be difficult to bring back 5 million jobs.
Right, and the Obama administration claims that the president has brought back manufacturing jobs. So their line is if Trump can replicate the carrier deal where he convinced Carrier to keep a few hundred jobs in Indianapolis, if he can replicate that 800 times over, he'll have matched Obama's job creation record.
And well, how accurate is the Obama administration's claims?
It's a good question. I mean, they're measuring from the depth of the recession that started right as Obama was taking office. So they've got a favorable baseline, I guess you could say.
Right. Well, let's talk about the Twitter effect. And GM saw its stock price dive last week. Toyota also had a problem with that. How powerful and important are those tweets?
It's pretty amazing, actually. It's unprecedented, and it's sort of remarkable that the president-elect can have this kind of power with a Twitter account. So I think that's worth noting. I think that these effects are going to be ephemeral. The Toyota is a good example. Their share price slid 3% last week, right after Trump issued his tweet. They've been flat since, but I wouldn't expect their shares to keep sliding based on a Trump tweet. I think most of these companies are going to see rebounds.
Well, so is it a little bit like the boy who cried wolf, that people will just get used to the tweets and ignore them, traders on Wall Street, maybe even journalists?
Yeah, right. Or they'll get priced in, you know, when a company announces in an SEC filing that they're planning to move jobs offshore, investors will take into account that the president may have something to say about that on social media.
But he has threatened these companies with border taxes or tariffs if they take jobs offshore.
Yeah. Yeah, his power there is it's a weird thing to say, but it's both broad and limited. He can sort of impose tariffs and dare these companies to challenge him in court. But if they did, he would probably lose. That wouldn't necessarily stop him from slapping on the tariffs in the first place, though.
But could he get Congress to go along with that and enact some kind of law that would, I don't know, punish companies to, you know, some tax laws that would punish companies for doing that?
I think his only chance of getting a permanent tariff regime for cross-border imports is to get some sort of a provision in a broader tax bill that Congress would pass. But I think when he tries to do that, he's going to find out how different he is from the rest of the Republican Party in Washington.
And have they come out and said that they're opposed to this yet?
They've said nothing for the most part, which I think speaks volumes by itself. There are no Republicans in Washington lining up to say, yes, let's slap 35% tariffs on companies who shift manufacturing across the border to Mexico.
Interesting. Well, so this idea of globalization, you've got wages in Mexico something like 80% lower than in the United States.
It's sure.
It seems irresistible for companies to hire Mexican workers.
Yeah, it is. That's why companies pressed for NAFTA in the 90s, so that they could do this. They could move jobs to Mexico and import back into the United States tariff-free. If Donald Trump wants to change that, he'll probably have to start by getting out of NAFTA.
Mm-hmm. And so getting back to the Jack Ma meeting today, Donald Trump has had some war of the words, at least on his Twitter account, with China in general, and talking about how China imposes unfair currency manipulation and the rest. And then he's meeting with one of China's leading businessmen. So what's happening?
He is a walking contradiction, this president, right? He's cautioned in the past about United States policy with regard to Russia, and now as president-elect, he's saying that we need to have a better relationship with Russia. He threatens China with practically a trade war, and then he also meets with one of their most prominent billionaires and businessmen. It's hard for me to make sense of it, honestly. I think that if he sees an opportunity to bring jobs to the United States, he takes advantage of it. I'm not sure he's really thinking of the geopolitical implications of bringing in a Chinese businessman to talk about job creation in the United States, honestly.
Alex Wayne, White House editor for Bloomberg News. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, an industry here in California may need to go on a hiring spree soon, and that industry is hemp. In November, California legalized recreational marijuana with Proposition 64, but 64 also allows for the industrial production of hemp. Hemp boosters say cultivation could pull in more money than weed, and California could dominate the U.S. market. Others are skeptical. Jonathan Calkin is a professor at Carnegie Mellon University who has studied drug policy for 30 years. Welcome to you.
Good afternoon.
And Lawrence Serbin is the owner of Hemp Traders, a company in Paramount, California that supplies hemp products nationwide. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you, Lawrence, are pretty bullish on hemp.
Oh, absolutely. I've been working with hemp for 27 years.
How big is it here in California?
Right now, it's actually very small because up until about a month or two ago, we haven't been able to grow it. So we've never had any production. All of my business so far has been to import the hemp and bring it here and then sell it throughout the California and the country.
So now you're hoping with legalized marijuana, that'll change?
Well, legalized marijuana is one thing, but what I focus on is legalized industrial hemp. So that would be not smoking flower, but rather flower for CBD and medicine. It could be fiber for textiles, twine, yarn, rope, webbing. It could also be hemp herds for building materials, particle board. We could make wood to replace trees. We could use paper. And also the seeds is a source of food. Hemp seed is known as a superfood right now. So I believe there's actually more money to be made in the industrial side of hemp than there is in the recreational marijuana.
So Lawrence Serbin, this sounds like a miracle plant.
It's one of the few plants where you can get like four or five raw materials from it. From the flower, you can get medicine. From the seeds, you can get food. From the stalks, you can get fiber for textiles and clothing. And also from the stalks, you can get building materials to make a home. So from one plant, you can get food, shelter, and medicine.
Incredible. Jonathan Calkin, I believe you're skeptical.
Yeah, I don't want to be too negative. It is absolutely true that it's a pretty amazing plant, and you can produce this wide range of products. But the simple fact that Mr. Serbin's been importing it says it's legal to produce elsewhere. And so the bet that it's going to be transformative to legalize it here is a bet that American farmers are going to be able to do something that Canadian farmers haven't. Maybe they can, but Canadian farmers are pretty good, too.
Well, is it just the fact, though, that it hasn't been able to take off in California because of the laws and because California is an agricultural powerhouse that could change the equation?
It might. But again, you're betting that growing it in California will allow things to happen that haven't been able to happen when it's been able to be grown in Canada, many countries in Europe. China is the world's leader in production.
And why hasn't it taken off then?
I think the main reason is that it is outcompeted by other plants and synthetics in most of the applications. Now, the CBD is sort of a special case, but that leave that aside. Most of the acreage would come from the fiber seeds and herd production. And it was a big deal 150 years ago, but other things came along and displaced it even before there was a prohibition.
And CBD, that is the compound in the plant that treats medical problems like epilepsy, correct?
Yeah, epilepsy in particular. There are many medical claims for THC also. CBD is a drug in the sense of a medicine. It is not a drug in the sense of an intoxicant.
Okay, so Lawrence, given what Jonathan just said about other materials and other plants superseding hemp in other places in the world, why do you think that that would change?
No, that's a very good question. The main reason has to do with the logistics of it. Right now, we can grow the hemp for something like flowers, you know, grown here and we can use it, but things like fiber and stalk, up until now, we've had to import all of that. So that means it has to be grown in China and then transferred all the way to the U.S. or even to other places in China to be worked with or to be manufactured. If we're growing it all in California, all of a sudden that opens up a lot more opportunities because now we can get there's a lot less transportation costs to incur in moving the raw material around, because it can all be done here. Two, we're also going to use modern technology. A lot of the hemp that's grown throughout the world, especially in China, is still being processed by hand quite a bit. And then three, when we grow it all together, we can have a farmer, per se, grow it for the seed. Then he's going to make all his money off of the seed or the flower, but then he'll have the stock. And the stock then will be a leftover waste product that is sold at a much, much lower cost than it would have traditionally been sold for.
And Jonathan, what about those considerations that it's just it'll be cheaper to grow and to manufacture, and that'll open up a whole new industry here in California?
I mean, it could be. I mean, one of the things I try to remind people is that this whole world of legalization is very different, and we'll have to see how it plays out. But take, for instance, making a shirt. So why is it that my shirt that's going to be made out of hemp fiber should be manufactured in the United States at all? Well, most clothes are not made in the United States anymore anyhow. So the fact that you can now produce it in California, but you don't normally want to make clothes in California anyhow. We'll see. The other thing I'm a little skeptical on is this idea that you're going to make all the money on the flower and then have all this fiber left over, because the total acres needed to produce all of the THC for the United States is like 5,000 acres. That sounds like a lot, but it's actually a very, very small amount as an agricultural commodity goes. So I think most of the fiber seed and herd is going to be produced by industrial hemp plants that are only used for those products, not going to have anything to do with selling flour for THC.
Okay, we have run out of time, so we will end it there. Jonathan Calkin, professor at Carnegie Mellon University, also co-author of Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know, and Lawrence Serban, owner of Hemp Traders. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Coming up, more than 20,000 people were sterilized in California in the 20th century. It was outlawed in the 70s, but not in prisons until a couple of years ago.
Between 2006 and 2010, 150 female prisoners in California state prisons were sterilized in unauthorized procedures.
The shameful history of forced sterilization and why the state hasn't really come to terms with that, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Eugenics laws, or the forcible sterilization of people deemed unfit to procreate, are a really shameful part of America's history. More than 30 states at some point had sterilization programs during the 20th century, and perhaps no state had a more active program than California. At its height, more than 20,000 people were forcibly sterilized, a third of all the sterilizations nationwide. People like Charlie Follett, who described his sterilization as a teenager in a CNN interview 5 years ago.
Darcy shot me with some kind of medicine, supposed to deaden the nerves. Then the next thing I heard was snip, snip, and that was it.
Did they tell you what they were doing to you?
No.
Hundreds of people like Follett could still be alive, according to Alexandra Minna Stern. She's a professor at the University of Michigan, and she's been trying to identify and create a database of all the people who are sterilized in California, and she's here now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, why did you begin this project? Why do you want to create this database?
I've studied this issue for quite a long time. I published a book on the topic of eugenics in California in 2005, but I still knew very little about sterilizations, particularly who was sterilized, what happened behind the walls of the about 10 institutions where these operations took place. And then, lo and behold, in 2007, I discovered microfilm reels, which contained just that information and is allowing us to reconstruct a demographic profile of who was sterilized and identify all of these individuals.
Where was this microfilm?
It was in Sacramento in what was then the Department of Mental Health, which is now the Department of State Hospitals. And it was very smartly microfilmed by the statistician, as the story was told to me, in the 1970s. and had sat there in the file cabinet for quite some time.
And so this program took place for basically the first half of the 20th century, right?
Yeah. So California passed the third sterilization law in the nation in 1909, and the law was on the books until its repeal in 1979. The majority of these operations took place between 1920 and to 1953, and that indeed is covers the bulk of what we have in our data set.
And the 10 institutions, were these mental hospitals?
They were a mix. About seven or eight of them were what used to be called, quote unquote, insane asylums. So what we'd call state-run psychiatric facilities. And the other two were what were called at the time feeble-minded homes, which would, you know, roughly translate today, understood in those pejorative terms of the past, as people with developmental or intellectual disabilities, although the lines between who was in what institution were very fluid, and diagnoses were, you know, could be quite capricious. So you have to take these diagnoses and these labels with many grains of salt.
So digging around and finding out exactly who would be likely candidates, do you come up with a profile of who would be chosen to be sterilized?
The law said it was people who were likely to, you know, create defective progeny, and they needed to be sterilized for that reason. One of the foremost reasons for sterilizations in the quote-unquote feeble-minded homes was low IQ. So in other words, IQ under 80, sometimes 70, anything below the 70 range, an individual would usually be sent for sterilization. Again, those IQ tests are hugely problematic and had many biases embedded in them. But nonetheless, that was one kind of category that was used. And also in the psychiatric hospitals, diagnoses such as dementia praecox, which is a precursor to the term today, schizophrenia, different forms of psychosis, manic depressive insanity, as the term was used at the time. But one of the things that's important to note beyond all these diagnoses is that it was vulnerable and largely disadvantaged people who ended up in the net, this public welfare net, and would be eventually sent to institutions. It should be noted, however, that at several of the institutions, to be released, you had to be sterilized. So sterilization was a precondition for release, and so it's understandable why some people might have opted or consented to the procedure, or a family member might have, in order to get that person out of the facility.
How many of the victims were sterilized because of their sexual orientation? Because homosexuality was considered a mental illness until not so long ago.
That's a very good question. I would say that sexual delinquency was one of the foremost reasons for sterilization, which actually is quite interesting because it suggests that sterilization was used not just as a eugenic tool to stop people from reproducing, but as a punitive form of control, as a way of punishing quote-unquote deviant sexual behavior. If we look across the spectrum of sexual delinquency, what you would find is young girls who were promiscuous, young boys who may have been having sex with other boys, and then older individuals where the same type of patterns were occurring. One of the things that's always challenging is taking our contemporary labels back and, you know, downstreaming them to the past and figuring out how they would apply. So how would we take a label such as LGBTQ and apply it to individuals in these records? If we put on that kind of frame and think about it, you know, I would say, and I don't have an exact number, that, you know, a good number, maybe in the range of 10% or something along, you know, that fuzzy, let's give it a fuzzy range, were individuals who were identified as LGBTQ in some way.
And how many people in total were sterilized in California in the 20th century?
The exact number I can't give you. It's not a precise science in that regard. But we do know from our records that almost 20,000 people were sterilized between the period from 1919 to 1953. The law was in force for a longer period of time, so one would assume that it has to be over 20,000. I would say that it's likely somewhere in the range of 22 to 24,000 because in addition to the records that we have, we know that at least 600 sterilizations occurred in San Quentin, in one of the state prisons. And also, it's important to note that sterilizations were also happening at the hands of private physicians who were reporting them to one of the foremost eugenics organizations in California at the time, the Human Betterment Foundation, which was based in Pasadena and was really a big proponent of sterilization as kind of a cure-all for societal problems.
Wow. And many of those people, as you surmise, are still alive. Have you spoken with some of them?
Well, I haven't spoken with any of the sterilization survivors. In our recent study, we estimate that 831 people are likely living today based on doing life tables analysis and, you know, looking at kind of the sequencing of time to the present day. That's one of the reasons why we published this article was in the hopes of galvanizing more interest in this issue and in ideally working with partners in the state legislature and other key stakeholders to use what we have essentially created, which is a registry of individuals sterilized by the state, to legally and in an ethically thoughtful manner to identify some of these living victims and to give them an opportunity to come forth, to tell their stories, and to consider the possibility of reparations. But also considering, you know, how do we make sure we don't forget this past? Between 2006 and 2010, 150 female prisoners in California state prisons were sterilized in unauthorized procedures. So that was yet another instance of sterilization abuse that resulted in a statewide law being passed which banned sterilizations in state prisons except in extreme circumstances.
And that law banning sterilization in state prisons, that was passed just in 2014. So talk about recent
history. That was exactly.
Well, what about the privacy of the individuals? And I wonder if some of them might feel some shame and they don't want to be in a registry or a database. They want to keep this a secret.
I think you raise a really good point, and that is why we need to have a bigger conversation about how to approach this issue. That is not something that I should decide, nor my research team should decide, but should be part of a thoughtful exploration among a group of stakeholders that would include representatives of the communities affected. For example, our research has shown that people with Spanish surnames were disproportionately sterilized. So, for example, we'd want representatives from Latino organizations, particularly those interested in reproductive issues. We would want representatives from the disability and the mental health community, as well as interested legislators, scholars, and others such as bioethicists who would help us think through, you know, how do you navigate this really tricky terrain? And I'm pretty confident that collectively, we could figure that out and we could come up with a good way of moving forward.
So this was going on well after World War II, even though the Nazis' eugenics program was well known and vilified. This still went on despite that?
Yes, it did. I think one of the things that explains why sterilizations continued is that first, well, there's several reasons. First, they'd become really routinized. It was just the way things were done. The second is that, you know, this was the logic behind sterilization in the United States. It was not an explicitly racial logic, although it was racialized. What I mean is that if you look at the law didn't target specific racial or ethnic groups. The law targeted people with what we would call today people with intellectual disabilities or mental health issues. The way it played out was that those categories and those people themselves were racialized, and the process of sterilization, the patterns themselves were racialized. Many of the reformers or the psychologists or the whole welfare apparatus at the time did have racial biases. Hmm. So there was an expectation that Mexicans or at that point Italians or Poles would have lower IQs, African Americans would be more subnormal than white people. So that was almost through osmosis. I mean, that was just built into the very tests that they were using, for example, when they did IQ tests mm-hmm. or the assumptions they had about mental disease.
So given the fact that other states have come to terms with their history, North Carolina and Virginia, for example, they've paid reparations, why do you think California has been reluctant?
That's a very good question. I would say there's a few reasons why. First, this issue was addressed in 2003, and the governor then did issue a public apology. So perhaps there was the idea that, well, this has been taken care of, this chapter has been closed. Another reason would be that at that point, even so, we didn't know much of anything about the people who were sterilized. And unlike states such as North Carolina and Virginia, where sterilization victims came forth and worked with mental health advocates to push for reparations, nothing like that has happened in California. We've had silence on behalf of the sterilization victims. I think in part that's because the state has not made a concerted effort to seek out these individuals and to figure out what would be the best way to proceed to find them. And right now it's kind of a race against the clock. We estimate over 800 people are alive today, but these people we estimate are in their 80s, if not late 80s. So the need to identify them is, kind of urgent.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Alexandra Minna-Stern. She's a professor at the University of Michigan, and she's working on a database of all the people who are forcibly sterilized by the state of California. Coming up, how Teen Vogue has decided to get political. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Recently, a scathing editorial about Donald Trump went viral, but internet reaction was less about the article itself and more about where it came from. Teen Vogue. That's a magazine traditionally associated with stories about makeup, fashion, and lifestyle for young women. But its writers are now tackling complex topics like Standing Rock and Black Lives Matter. And that's thanks to a new editorial team, the editor of print, Elaine Welteroth. Hi, Elaine.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. And Phil Picardi, who runs the digital side. Hi, Phil.
Hi.
Okay, so you both took over Teen Vogue back in May. And did you intend to put more political stories in the magazine?
So this was more of a kind of a watershed moment, in Elaine's words. That was a buildup. But since we've, assumed these roles and taken over, yes, we've certainly hit our stride and have seen a lot of growth in terms of politics, and our wellness vertical tackles issues like sexual health and reproductive rights and gender identity. And we've seen great engagement and growth around those stories, which is why we've devoted more real estate to them.
And Elaine, how does that translate onto the print side? Do you have the same amount of articles in the magazine as there are online?
In book, you see a lot of the same themes explored, but in a different way. I think our approach is to pair the right voices to tackle these issues in longer form conversations, Q&As, or even first person pieces. So for instance, in our September Four Girls, Five Girls issue, we had Hillary Clinton write a first person essay for Teen Vogue that really speaks directly to young people about how to use their voices to speak up on the issues that really matter the most to them. In our Smart Girls issue, which is on newsstands now, we have Michelle Obama in conversation with Zendaya talking about global education for girls around the world. And, we have Amanda Sandberg and Gloria Steinem talking about feminism from the perspective of two different generations. So I think, our goal is to tackle those larger issues that matter to our reader in a bigger, beautiful way, and to create a collector, collector's item or a keepsake that they can keep with them for years.
So moving forward, these are all Democrats. Would you want to have people in the Trump administration or Trump's family, Melania Trump, for example? Would you want to have her in your magazine?
I always like to say that, Teen Vogue is very much an issues-oriented space. So we cover things that directly are affecting and impacting our readers' lives. And we choose to do so by highlighting people and having conversations with people who are implementing progress in that space.
So would that be a yes or a no in terms of what I just asked?
I can say from a print standpoint, we don't know. We have to wait and see what happens. That's the unique advantage of working at a print magazine is we have some lead time to watch what's happening with culture and to see what's happening in the news and to see how it's affecting our girls. And so let's wait and see.
And, you know, we do op-ed features on teenvogue.com. One just ran about Dylann Roof, and there were, you know, there was a college Republican featured in that essay. We also profiled George Bush's former press secretary. So there's certainly space to do so. And we hope, you know, that we can find more ways to do so in the future.
And how do you know if what you're doing is working?
Well, we've had some pretty tremendous growth statistics. I mean, Lauren's piece, as you mentioned, went viral. And you know, so that was a really unique case scenario of a story that really took off. But the most successful day in our site's history actually was the day after the election, where we had 1.2 million unique visitors to the site in one day. Traffic is up 208%. And that's just under a 2-year span.
And so it, specifically what you're talking about, what's driving the traffic is the more in-depth news-focused coverage?
It's always, you know, a balance with teenvogue.com. Our top 5 stories of the year are Lauren's story, Donald Trump is Gaslighting America, followed quickly thereafter by How to Apply Glitter Nail Polish the Right Way. Our girl is not uniquely interested in politics, and she's not uniquely interested in beauty. She can do both. I like sometimes watching The Real Housewives, and I also read The New York Times every day. So, you know, you can contain multitudes.
And Elaine, talk about how you want to cover sexuality, gender issues, things along those lines that aren't along the traditional, you know, 10 ways to please your man kind of articles.
Yeah, I think that type of language has never really been a part of the brand equity of Teen Vogue from its inception. And I don't think you will be seeing stories like that in Teen Vogue going forward. But you will see nuanced discussions about relationships, sexuality, body politics, gender identity, kind of all through the lens of self-love.
What's the average age of your reader?
The majority of our audience is comprised in that 18 to 24 demographic.
So not even teens, I mean, by definition, unless 18, 19, but...
Yes, I suppose that, you know, that's, you know, internally, and I think at Teen Vogue, we've always said that, you know, the average age is going to be, or our sweet spot is really that targeted 18-year-old. So I think people are surprised to hear that.
And you two are pretty young by magazine standards, right? Phil, you're 25 and Elaine, you're 30, I understand?
As of last week.
Happy birthday. And how does that figure into how you relate to your audience, that you're closer to them than probably most of your peers?
I think it gives us a unique advantage in the sense that we can recall what it's like to be a teenager or coming of age. And, you know, we know how confusing that can be. And so we really feel a passion to serve as role models for those girls and to girls and boys, for that matter.
What is that, Aaliyah song?
What song?
AJ Nothing But a Number.
AJ Nothing. In many ways, we relate to our audience. You know, we are diehard Snapchatters. We're constantly on social media. We, you know, enjoy makeup and Bieber and, you know, just as much as we really care about what's happening in the world around us. And so I think it doesn't take a leap for us to understand what our readers are going through and really what they're craving.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
That's Elaine Welteroth, print editor at Teen Vogue, and Philip Picardi, the magazine's digital editor. And Julie Myers is here now. Hi.
Hello.
Did you read Teen Vogue when you were a teen?
No. My sister got YM, Young and Modern, which you just pointed out
formerly
to me during...
Young Miss?
It was called Young Miss? Good Lord. We've come a long way, baby.
Young Ms.
Young Ms? Yeah. That I probably would have read. But YM, yeah. Workout tips to get your beach body. What they didn't say was that any body on a beach
everywhere
is a beach body.
Yeah.
So we talked about the Golden Globes. That's what everybody's talking about right now. And we wanted to know what people's highlights and lowlights are. And man, our listeners just love them some Meryl Streep. Monica Palacios says, Meryl Streep is my god. Instead of talking about her career at the Golden Globes, she spoke her truth, her concerns about our current political climate. And she called out the president-elect without even mentioning his name. Hashtag Meryl Streep 2020. Wonder. She's already conquered the acting world. Perhaps she'll go on to the presidency next. Lori Green says that Meryl Streep's speech was brilliant and gracious and heartbreaking. She's reminding us not to let the hateful treatment of others become normal. So all around support for Meryl Streep. If you dissent, do so on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play.
All right. Thank you, Julie Myers. And thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.